Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Hello everybody and welcome again to the Motorsport Podcast. It's great to have you with us, and I tell you, this time we have a real treat in store for you, but I'm not going to tell you who it is until I've told you about our latest subscription offer. And as you know, this is very important to us, because the more of you who subscribe, the longer and stronger we will continue. And if you don't subscribe, we'll send Jean Todt to see you, okay? So I hope you'll enjoy our new offer, which means you can save over £52 when you subscribe to Motorsport for 2 years. In the UK, it means for 1 year, it'll cost you £36.80, and for 2 years, £67.20. For full details of all these prices around the world, please go to our website, motorsportmagazine.com. And don't forget that when you do subscribe, you get the iPad edition absolutely free. And if you haven't yet seen our iPad edition, I suggest you do. It's absolutely fantastic. There's more in there than there is in the magazine itself. And I will repeat those prices at the end of the show. Anyway, as I said, we're in for a real treat today, because we have with us one of the senior citizens of British motor racing, the president himself, the president of the British Racing Drivers Club, a former Superstocks world champion, a Formula 3 champion, when Formula 3 really mattered, of course, blitzed Formula 2 and into Formula 1, a Grand Prix driver, Derek Warwick. And Derek, thank you very much for popping in from Jersey to see us today.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Good. Well, that's a good start anyway, isn't it? We'll see what we can do, Derek. Okay, we've got a lot of questions from our readers, which is great news, because after all, this is all about you, the readers. It's not just about us lot around this table. But Derek, if I could just get the ball rolling and talk briefly about the current Formula One season. I don't want to talk about tyres, because if I hear another word about tyres, I don't know what I'll do, but one thing that, can I just ask you, it really interested me about Bahrain was, why did the stewards allow all four wheels off the racetrack in an overtaking manoeuvre? I don't get that.
Because it wasn't Lewis Hamilton pushing the other car off the track. Because I do believe that had it been Lewis in Nico's car, he would have got penalised, you know, because people are a little bit anti-Lewis at the moment. I have to say that, you know, I've been a steward now for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I have to say that we have a lot more camera angles than what you and I saw on the television. So as a Grand Prix anorak, I only saw what you saw. And I thought the Nico situation was too tough. I thought against Alonso, it was acceptable, even though Alonso didn't, and have tweeted since to say we now have an open book, that we're now going to have an interesting season. So I think he was warning Nico that he's going to get one back on him. But the Lewis thing, I just think it was too strong. I think he was pushing him too far. He knew he was on the outside of him, and he pushed him right onto the sand, gravel, whatever you want to call it. But if you saw it in slow-mo, the Armco was just coming out for the relief vehicles, so it could have been a big accident. And I'm surprised, but knowing that the stewards that were there, I think the driver steward was Pirro, and that does leave a bit of a question mark, I suppose. But that aside,
he's racing. Huh?
I know. But getting back to the racing in general, what fantastic year we're having. Yeah. You know, I thought last year was good. You know, yeah, sure, Vettel walked the season, but it never felt during the course of last year that he walked the season.
Right.
You know, I was really waiting for the next race, he just scraped pole, and he was pushed all the way. If it wasn't by Webber, it was by Lewis or Jensen or somebody or Alonso. So it was a great season last year, and this year has just been amazing. I mean, since China, really, China and Bahrain, I think has been absolutely fantastic racing. You know, and whereas I would quite often watch the race on Sky, an hour behind, so I can fast forward. Well, actually, I used to fast forward so that I could fast forward Eddie Jordan, but I don't need to do that anymore now because I'm on Sky. But you still fast forward the boring bits. But every time you press the fast forward button, something else was happening. So I've watched both races completely live, and they've been fantastic races.
There must have been times that during your career when you'd quite like to have fast forwarded certain people, I imagine.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, I can think of quite a few people, actually, yeah. But no, the racing has been great. Overtaking, I think DRS, has been a lot of question marks and a lot of discussion on DRS. I've always thought it was going to be a good tool. KERS, I'm still a bit confused with because I'm not sure sometimes when KERS is working or not, because I understand that obviously the Red Bull has a lot of problem with the KERS. But I think DRS is great. And when you are in the stewards' room during practice, when they can use DRS all the time, they are on that DRS button all the time, you know, and it's fascinating to watch. And I just think it's a great tool, you know. And somebody says to me the other day, it's fabricating overtaking, but it's no different than my day when we had turbos, when we had the overboost. You know, I used the overboost to overtake cars. Okay, I didn't overtake too many, but that was the principle anyway.
Yeah, the only difference was, though, Derek, when you were using it, if he so wanted, the guy you were overtaking could also use it to protect himself.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, yeah. Are you not a fan then, Nigel?
No, I'm not. No, because to me, when the car behind has its wing open, those two cars are not in the same spec.
No, but he has got the...
And I just think, why, if they would just once and for all confront the fundamental problems that aerodynamics present in terms of overtaking. I think it's a... I can't even remember now which driver it was. It first started last year, it was somebody, might have been Fernando, but somebody described it as a gimmick. And I think it's a sort of artificial means of getting round a problem which has never really been properly addressed.
But to address the problem, you've got to take off the aerodynamics. And do we really want to see a Grand Prix car without wings? Because that's really what you have to do.
No, although, oddly enough, I was just saying to Rob 10 minutes ago, I remember probably at least 15 years ago, I remember Patrick Head one day saying to me, he did once in a while think to himself, wouldn't it be fun if the FIA just said overnight, right, next season, you have no wings. Get on with it.
Mm. Where would you put the sponsors?
That was the whole point. That was what Patrick said, that he'd mentioned it to Frank, this idea, and Frank immediately became hysterical at the thought of, you know, all that advertising space going. But he just said it would be such a challenge. Okay, this is what we got, so what do we do?
There was a year, Nigel, we didn't have front wings. You remember the khaki car, the Williams car with no front wings?
Yeah.
So much downforce.
That's right.
Were they able to run closer in them days? I can't remember.
That was 82.
82, that's right.
I think they were, because in those days, so much of the downforce, because in those, it was before we had flat bottom Formula One cars, you remember, a lot of the downforce was still coming from ground effect, from shaped underbodies,
I'm such a massive fan of Nigel Roebuck. I read everything he writes, and I love what he writes. But now I'm across the table, and he's talking rubbish. And it's such a shame, really. No, I'm only joking. I kind of disagree, just because I think if it makes the spectacle better, it's good for Formula One. It's good for television, and that has to be good for Formula One. So, I do kind of take your theory, Nigel, except that if we're seeing overtaking, then that same person has the option of doing it the next lap.
Yeah, if they can get stay within 1 second.
Well, then in that case, you shouldn't be in front of him or behind him.
Well, no, all right. It isn't. But I mean, for instance, somebody was making the point about Jensen in Canada last year, which was a truly fantastic drive. No one's arguing with it. But people were saying, had we not had DRS, you know, probably Jensen wouldn't have won, and Michael probably would have been second, in fact. Where it offends me most is, like, Webber's pass of Alonso at Eau Rouge last year was one of those all-time shut-your-eyes-and-did-it-really-happen moments. Just, you know, mind-blowing.
It was exciting.
I thought,
very exciting.
I can never remember a competitive pass at Eau Rouge before. But the next lap, you know, they went through Eau Rouge, Mark's ahead, up the hill to Les Combes, and Alonso just opened his DRS and straight past, and the whole thing had been for nothing.
I do worry that Formula One gets too plastic, you know, with only able to make one move on the straight. Okay, we could argue for safety, it's right. But hey, you know, man up. You know, if I want to block you, you know, isn't that what motor racing was about? You know, and there's rules coming in, the blue flag rule with the slower car they come up to lap to make it, obviously, so it doesn't interfere with the race. Well, in my day, you didn't have that, of course. You know, you had to fight your way past a back marker. And that kind of made the race more interesting. And all the rules are really favouring the top six drivers.
Yeah,
because if I was a back marker, I would not be happy that I would have to get out onto all those marbles and basically cost me two or three laps then to clean my tyres in order to race with the people that I have to race with. You know, my other Caterhams and HRTs and all that sort of stuff. So I feel sorry for the back markers, because in all these rule changes, they are completely forgotten. Yeah. You know, they're almost unimportant.
They're forgotten in general, actually.
They are, and I must say, I mean, I thought what happened in Malaysia, I thought it was an interesting contrast there, actually, between Jensen and Sebastian. If you remember, they both had moments with Naren Kartikeyan in the race. And I don't know about you, but I mean, I thought Kartikeyan was not at fault in either.
No, I agree. I agree with that.
In either incident,
he couldn't just disappear, could he?
No, he couldn't. But I was highly impressed that Jensen immediately fronted up and said it was me. Whereas Sebastian was screaming about it afterwards and saying, you know, about people like this shouldn't be in Formula One and all
different
the rest
people,
of it.
Aren't they?
And I just thought then. Just what we're saying, really, about the backmarkers. It is so easy to bully backmarkers, both on the track and, you know, and verbally. And I felt very sorry for Kartikeyan. I'm glad he's still to cover.
I don't think
himself.
They're being bullied. Actually, I don't think they've got any option. You know, if they go past three corners with a blue flag, they either get a drive through. So it's not being bullied. They've actually been taken out of the race. You know, I think bullying is about when you put pressure on a guy and force him into a mistake, and then push him out the way. You know, yeah. I think with the Kartikeyan situation, you could argue that it was not really his fault with Jensen, but he did move over on Vettel. If you look at the slow-mo and look at the front camera angle, he did come out of that corner and come across the track. I'm not saying it's right.
No. That is true. But it seemed to me, I must say, watching the slow-mo, that at the same moment they sort of went towards each other. I think. Kartikeyan went slightly right and Vettel went slightly left.
Got to remember one thing here, Nigel, and that was that, if I remember rightly, Vettel was racing Kartikeyan. Didn't he just have a pit stop when he come through, and he wasn't lapping him? Wasn't he racing him?
Yeah, he was, actually. He was. No, that's right, he was.
That's true.
So that's quite a different situation. Yeah. He's used to him popping out of the way.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden,
But watching some of the backmarkers when they get out of the way, I mean, they get so far out of the way, they must be losing seconds a lap.
That's what Derek says.
Yeah, and it's too much. But I suppose the thing with Vettel and Button is that Vettel's never really had a bad Formula One car, and he's never had to dive out of the way of people. I know
it was very exciting. I'm sorry to hark about the old days, but it was really exciting when the leaders came up behind the back mask, because you thought, right, who's going to make the best job of this? Who's going to go left, right, who's going to...
But we all remember Monaco, when I think it was Coulthard or somebody being held up for 28, 30 laps by the arrows.
Geez, yes.
Bernaldi, wasn't it?
Sorry?
Yes, Bernaldi.
Bernaldi. I mean, that is just outrageous. Yeah. You know, it is absolutely outrageous. So we've sort of gone too far maybe for to cure the problem.
But you had a few drivers in the '80s who were known as blockers, like, you know, the Arnoux and De Cesaris of this world were.
Well, I mean, the original one was the first one was Mike Beutler. Mm. Mike Beutler's nickname was Blocker. Yes. And at the time, it was he was given that name because at the time everybody thought what he was doing was completely, you know, beyond the pale.
But I think, you know, and again, I agree with you, Rob. We shouldn't go back to the old days when I raced. We should be talking about present day. But I hope this comes out the right way. We remembered when we got blocked. We remembered when our best qualifying lap got held up by even a front runner, whether it was Ayrton or De Cesaris or whatever. You know, there was always those rumours that drivers used to put a black mark on the sun visor. And you did remember. And we made sure we got even, if not the next race, the race after that. And that's why people respected each other, because they knew that if they blocked me, they had one coming before the end of the season.
But you see, I think that mentality still has always applied and still does apply in NASCAR, doesn't it? I mean, they still work to those rules, and they all accept it. Yeah. And they all know, boy, you know, what's coming to me sooner
or later.
Well,
just the other day, somebody got, I forget the two drivers, but he put them in the wall. And afterwards, when he was interviewed, he said, that was for Charlotte last year.
Yeah.
He used his opportunity.
Yes.
Oh, we love NASCAR. NASCAR. Oh, we do, yeah. Did you ever think about doing it? Because you it would
not
be
NASCAR. No, I went and drove the Pennzoil for Rob Hall, not Rob Hall, Jim Hall, in the end of '92, and I was going to make a switch to Indy cars in '93. I drove at Mid Ohio in the Andretti car, not raced. This was just testing. 2 days there, really, really quick, really pleased. Jim wanted me to sign for '93. And before I'd left, Eddie Jordan came on the phone and said, I want you to drive for me for '93. And at the same time, so did Jackie Oliver. And I went to see Oliver and footwork, and I quite liked what he had there. Eddie, as usual, was a bit fluffy, and you weren't really sure whether you were going to actually get the drive or not. And Formula One was always my life, and so I made the decision to come back with and race footwork in '93. So I would have gone Indy cars. With hindsight, I'm really glad I didn't, because I think me and those walls might have had a bit of an argument during the course of the season.
Can you remember what that car was like to drive? Because you remember when Ayrton had a day in a factory Penske when he was disillusioned with the state of Formula One at the end of '92. And his great mate Emerson said, "Well, you know, come and have a go in my car." And Ayrton drove it and absolutely adored it, because the Formula One cars at the time had every gizmo going, and Ayrton just said, this is a human's car.
Yeah, it was like,
and a lot of power, and you know.
Now, I thought it was a bit like driving a bucket. You know, you kind of felt that it was big. It was made for all shapes and sizes of driver. It was, you know, it was a production car, and I was so used to having a little car made for me that getting out there just seemed like I was going back in time. Because for sure, the technology, as you just rightly said, was like going back 5 years. Yeah. You know, and that kind of appeals to some people more than others. You know.
Well, he liked the fact that he didn't have traction control. It had a gearbox that he had to operate, you know, and a lot of power at the same time.
It's amazing. If you'd gone to Indy racing in '93, you'd have been racing against Nigel Mansell.
So you would.
I've gone all hot again.
you must have got used to in your career going from, as you say, sort of production type racing cars, because you did lots of sports cars as well, mixing between Formula One and sports cars. And that's the same sort of thing, isn't it? You're getting into a car that's built for all sorts of different people. And
yeah, but it was still built for you. What I mean by that is '86, when I had a year out, when the whole Ayrton Senna thing happened at the end of '85, I was without a drive in '86, So obviously I signed for Jaguar, but the car was, although you're right, it's made for all shapes and sizes, it was still a Pacific car. It wasn't a production car that was made for 20 teams. It was your car, your team. Yeah. You know, and it was the same in 91, and the same with Jaguar again when I signed for Jaguar in 91, and it was the same in 92 with Peugeot. I suppose you could argue that the 956 and 962 Porsche was a production car, which I drove, not the safest cars in the world. But
and those late Group C cars you drove, the Jag and the Peugeot, they were better than most of the Grand Prix cars you drove, weren't they?
By a country mile. Somebody said to me the other day, what was the worst car you ever drove? And I said, well, how long have you got? You know, I mean, I do have a top 10, and I just, in the top five, I still keep moving around in my own mind. No, I was lucky. I drove the best sports cars, or one of the best sports cars in 86. Just missed the World Championship by 2 points. Because the car went on 10 cylinders at the end of the race. I finished second in 91 because I got disqualified from a win at Silverstone, and won in 92. So great cars to drive, really fun to drive, hard work, long slogs. I just adored long distance racing. I thought the 6 hour races, and in particular Le Mans, I would go back and race Le Mans now. Really? Just because I just love the teamwork. I love driving through the night. I did triple stints at night. I love the rain. I love the sun coming up in the morning. I love smelling the bacon in the morning. It was just all. I think the reason I really love sports car racing was because, as you just said, I always had the good cars. So, you know, for me, winning's always been easy. Losing's difficult, you know, and when you're in a bad car and running at the back of the grid, or even running mid-grid, like we quite often did, that's hard work. You know, get yourself up and get back into the car for the next race, knowing full well that you were 2 seconds off pace. That was tough. But, you know, to get back in the car, knowing you can put it on pole and win the race again, like the sports cars, that was cool. I enjoyed that.
Well, Derek, just while you're on there, talking about the worst car you ever drove, if you mentioned it, say to Jackie Stewart, he immediately says his Matra MS80 that he won his first championship in. Which is your, if you have a favourite car, where does the Peugeot come, for instance?
Favourite car, I think, was probably 84 Renault, you know, because that car was capable of winning. It was quite unreliable, but it was a winning car. So I enjoyed 84. I enjoyed 89, the little Ross Brawn Arrows, a supercar. Could have won Canada, and had we had a bit more money, could have won, you know, could have been on the podium quite a few times. The XJR14 Jaguar 91, what a car. I mean, that had so much downforce. It was fantastic. And I preferred that to the Peugeot of 92, really? For sure. Yeah, definitely.
I just wondered, the Peugeot always looked such a sort of small, light, you know, manageable car.
It was XJR14.
Yeah, really.
Wow.
Really.
You know, it was just superb. I remember the first day we tested it or shook it down was on the South Circuit at Silverstone. And on the old South Circuit, just before the temporary pits, was a fast flat right-hander. Well, actually, it wasn't flat. But I did the installation lap. And I just, as I went back out again, I thought, what is this car all about? And as I went through the kink on the first flying lap, I was flat. And I remember laughing like hell, because Ross and everybody that was in the temporary pits ducked behind the barrier because they thought the throttles had stuck open. It was phenomenal, right out of the box, just amazing. And the Peugeot was great, and I loved it, and it won a lot of races for me, won Le Mans and the World Championship. So it was difficult for me not to put it up there, but it was still a big old heavy gearbox and hard, heavy brakes, and just hard. I mean, it was hard work to drive, really hard work to drive. But if we then start talking on the other end of the scale, worst cars. Right, okay. 792 March almost destroyed my career. because then to get the AT Tolman was pretty, I put a lot of work in getting that drive together. So 792 was shite. 81, 82, Tolman, Flying Pig, has to rank up there amongst the best, or the worst. 85 was probably the biggest disappointment, because the middle of 84, I'd had a 1-year contract with Renault. The car was good, almost won the first race, but you just felt that in them days that you had to stay with the manufacturer. And if I may remind you at this point, Nigel, I debated long and hard at the British Grand Prix in 84 as to what I should do with furthering my career. I had an offer from Williams for the 85 season, or to stay with a manufacturer. And Alan Henry, Nigel Roebuck, it was
Morris
Hamilton. We sat along that table and we discussed and looked at all the pros and cons, and we, between us all, said that we should stay with a manufacturer. And I think it was, I mean, even with hindsight now, if I go back and think about it, it was the right thing to do. What happened was, at the end of 84, we lost Michel Tertu, our mechanical engineer, Amigio, aerodynamicist, Larouste, team manager, and a couple of other key guys. We lost about 5 key guys. So when we went to build the 85 car, they were way down the pecking order. The car was just impossible to drive. We took it to Brazil beginning of 85, and it was 3.5 seconds slower than the 84 car, and it was a disaster. So that was 85 definitely ranks up there.
If I can interject to this point,
you're not going to spoil a good story.
No, not at all. No, all I would say to you is, you are entirely right in your memory, but the only thing to bear in mind is, if you remember when we were having that discussion, do you remember what a terrible, terrible car the Williams was in 1984?
Yeah.
It was the last aluminium car, in fact, wasn't it? Yeah. It was the last pre-carbon.
And the Honda engine didn't look particularly good at that stage.
The Honda engine was either on or off.
Exactly.
And Keke had that win in Dallas, but that was
lucky.
It was a brilliant drive, but it was, you know, if ever that car and engine combination was not going to win anywhere, it would have been there.
But so he won that race because I crashed, Nigel broke down.
Prost crashed, yeah. Nicky crashed.
The track broke up, didn't it?
Yeah. The track broke up, yeah.
And the amazing thing about it also is, if you remember, Arno was second coming from the back in the Ferrari.
Right.
Who would have bet on Arno staying on the track all
what
day?
What is the point conditions that you're making in defence of your
only, only that at the time, when Alan and Morris and I were talking this through with Derek, it did seem as though, and Renault at that time was in good shape too. So
with all the facts I had at the time, it was still the right choice. You know, I don't regret it at all, Nigel. I'm only joking, really. I mean, I don't regret it, and I've never regretted any bad decisions I've ever made in my life. You know, they were right at the time. And okay, some drivers seem to always be able to turn right at the right time, and some drivers have this uncanny knack of turning left at the wrong time, you know. So it's just one of those things, yeah.
And as it was, of course, when you turned Frank down and he signed,
oh my God, you're going to say it again, aren't you?
Of course, and nothing came of that, did it?
No.
I got to ask you, Derek, one of the things that's very interesting about your whole amazing career, bearing in mind how much you've done, is that you really came up the hard way. It sounds like a cliche, but you know, a lot of work went into it. Formula Ford, Formula 3, I mean, you were working as well as racing and all of that. And when in Formula 1, were you ever tempted to take the money, as it were? I mean, how much of a factor did the money become for you? Because it seems to me Formula 1 is a hell of a lot about that.
81, I earned 36 grand. I earned a few extra bob in 82. In 83, I was on just less than £60,000. So, you know, nothing at all. And then all of a sudden, Renault came along in 84 and offered me a pot of gold. And I do remember that when the contract came through by Telex, when the contract came through, we got very, very drunk that night. And it was the basis of our decision to move to Jersey, and which was another great decision I made, to be fair. And I moved to Jersey Jan 185, and I've been there now 27, 28 years, and I absolutely love the place. So, yeah, I mean, I think a part of that decision in 84 that we spoke about with Nigel just now, they were offering me an amazing amount of money for 85. And I do try and think back and think whether or not that did sway my decision to stay with Renault instead of going to Williams, which was much less money. And I do quite often think about that. And I have to say that it didn't. You know, it was, I had my three ex-journalist friends, and I think we made the decision for the right reason, because at the time, it was right to be with a manufacturer. You know, we didn't know those five key people were going to go. You know, I think that if I knew that the Williams was going to win, I would have gone there for nothing.
Right.
Winning is okay. What it's all about.
Yeah, it's just interesting.
You know, and I always remember, I think it was Nicky who said, don't worry about the money, just worry about the winning. Because if you win, the money will come.
The other thing was, of course, you know, who knew when you re-signed with Renault they were going to pull the plug at the end of 85. So,
I'm going to take, if this is all right with you, Mr. Editor, I'm going to take a few readers' questions because, for obvious reasons. And the first one comes from Phil Beckett, and he'd like to know, Derek, what you were thinking after the Monza 1990 accident when you. Typically of you, actually, I thought, got out, ran back, looking for another car to race. Were you actually a bit out of it?
No, not at all. I was too close to Guzman, or I can't remember, one of the I think it was Guzman in the
Leighton House.
Well done, thank you. In the Leighton House, in front of me, understeered off the car, off the track, going through the Parabolica on the first lap, but. I did. I had a sick sense that it was going to be a big accident because we were just three quarters round the Parabolica. So when I went off and hit the barrier, I knew it was going to be a big hit. And there's a lot of little things flash between. You know, they say that things flash between your in your mind when something big's going to happen, and they did. And there was a lot of little things that happened. Anyway, that's beside the point. Ripped off the left-hand side of the car, as we all know. Barrel rolled onto the circuit. Then everything went slow motion. As I'm going down on my helmet, basically, down the side of the circuit, it was probably still traveling at 1,800 miles an hour or whatever, I'm thinking, first of all, this hurts because my head was bouncing on the tarmac. So I had I was still awake enough to pull my head and keep my head off the tarmac. Then I thought, I've got 220 liters in here. If somebody hits me at the bottom of the car, this thing is gonna catch fire. Turned off the engine. Pulled the fire extinguisher, pulled off the steering wheel, and kept the steering wheel in my hands because I thought, when this thing stops, I want out of here. So as the car stopped, I thought I counted to like 10 seconds because I knew there was like, I don't know, 15, 18 cars behind me. So I thought I'd let all them go, but when I looked at the TV, obviously there were still cars coming by when I was still trying to get out. And then when I got out of the car, I looked back at the car, a little bit unsteady at first, but I looked back at the car and thought, we can't swear on this, can we swear?
Yeah.
I don't think I can use this word.
Well, give it a try,
It started with an F anyway, yeah. So I thought, this car is effed, and I then turned around and I thought, I'm at the pit entrance. If I can get back to my car, in my subconscious, I knew they'd have to throw a red flag. There's just no way they could race. I knew then I had 15 minutes to get back into the pits, get into the spare car, and get out. So I started to run, going back to the first of all, I ran into the Arrows garage, because obviously, you know, raced Arrows for 3 years. And I heard somebody say, no, the next one. So I ran in there, and in my mind, I knew that set 11 was my second best set of tyres. So I went into the garage, screamed at them, set 11. By that time, they were already preparing the car. And one of the engineers wanted my helmet. And I'm thinking he wants me to stop racing. So I said, no. But of course, they saw that half of it had ground right away. So took the helmet off, changed the helmet, and got into the car before anybody could get hold of me. You know, I knew I had to get into that car. So I got into that car, clamped it all down. And it was only the reality of what I did when I come round, when I did that the lap to the grid, because all the Italian fans were up in the stands, they were waving flags, and they were just so proud of what I did, I suppose. So it gave me a good feeling. Anyway, get back to the grid, get into my place again, and someone came over and said, Prof Watkins wants to see you. So got out of the car, went in, sat at the...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Back of the car with Prof Watkins, front door opened, and a little guy came in the front, Bernie. And he sat in the front, and Prof Watkins said to me, name? I said, Nelson Piquet. He said, no, Derek, he said, I'm being serious, I want your name. I said, Nigel Mansell. And we went on like this. And Bernie turned around in his typical aggressive way. If you don't tell him what's going on, he said, you're not going to race. So obviously, you know, I told him everything. And but you know what, though? I think two things that came out of that was, one is when I looked at a slow-mo of the race afterwards, and somebody was with a camera at the front of the car when I was in, got back into the spare car.
Yeah, I saw this.
My eyes were like teapots, you know what I mean? And I just think there's no way I should have raced. I started off with a massive headache, and when the clutch went on the 40th lap, I almost clapped. I mean, I was just, you know, I was tired in the car. I wasn't happy with myself, and no way I should have raced, you know. So, but anyway, you know, that's just the stupid things you do at the time.
Have you still got the helmet? I think there's someone was asking.
Yeah, no, I have. Yeah, no, I've got the helmet. I've got when I went upside down at Hockenheim. Went into the gravel. You know, I mean, when I think about it now, I hate it because people remember me of my crashes and not my wins.
I tell you, I remember that day so well because, I mean, it was one of those accidents where, of course, you know, everybody sort of went, oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, it was, doesn't need to be repeated. It was a huge, huge shunt. But when you got out the car and then started coming back to the pits, I remember that wall of sound from the grandstands. I mean, I've rarely heard anything.
But also from the mechanics. All the mechanics came out to the pit lane and was clapping me.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
I'm feeling a bit emotional just thinking about it.
Yeah.
My mother never spoke to me for about a month after that, you know that.
Is that right?
Yeah. She was so upset that I was stupid enough to get back into the spare car.
Yeah.
Bit of Superstocks racing was upside down quite a lot, really.
Yeah, and unconscious a few times as well. Yeah.
But not a parabolicus, Pete.
No, not a parabolicus.
Anyway.
I do remember getting banned for 3 months in when I was first racing Superstocks. I was at Aldershot Stadium, and I was white top, right at the start of the train, if you like, and start at the front of the grid, rather. And I led probably 8 or 10 races up until the last lap. Then the red tops would catch me up, and the three guys from Reading, Tony May, Jeff Garrard, Alan Freebuddy, would put me in the fence on the last lap, last corner, and win the race. So after about the 8th or 10th time, I was only 16, you know, young, but I was still quite quick. I obviously trying to win a race. And Tony May put me into the fence on the last corner, last lap at Aldershot. So I backed the car out. And by this time, he'd come round, taken the checkered flag, and then we used to do a lap of honour, still strapped in the car, with a checkered flag, waving the checkered flag. As he went up the back straight, I thought, right. I went across the centre reservation, and as he came down, I hit him in the side of the car, barrel rolled him over the top of the fence onto the dog track, and there he was, in a massive heap, almost next to the spectator enclosure, and I got banned for 3 months, and when I came back. Nobody touched me. So, you know, that was...
So you were born for NASCAR. You were born for NASCAR.
I'm born for NASCAR, yeah.
Future driver steward and future president of the BRDC.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I hand the badge in next week.
I still think that's one of the best motor racing stories. Because I remember you telling me this a long time ago. I love it. Okay, sorry, right.
Actually, I remember, I wasn't there, but I just remember the incident of the Nürburgring with, you know, the man who became the most successful Grand Prix driver of all time. Do you remember? In 91? Quentin Spurring told me this story when he was walking through the paddock and he Michael Schumacher ran past him,
yes.
Travelling at about 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Followed after about 30 seconds by you, and he's described how you looked at that moment.
There's a big story to this, though, Nigel. If you remember rightly, my brother was killed 10 days before. We buried him on the Friday. I went into court with some directors that were we had a few problems with within my business on the Monday morning. And I'd already made a promise to my mother that I wasn't going to race anymore. You know, my little brother just been killed, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of emotion flying around the Warwick household. And then Walkinshaw rang me and said, look, Derek, are you racing? You're not going to race. There's Nürburgring's coming up. And I said, you know what, Tom, I'm not really sure. He said, well, look, I'm going to take the cars to the A1 ring in Austria, and we will do a test there, and we'd like you to come along and see whether you still want to do it. So I had a big meeting with the family, and they were really, really upset, but I said, look, I'm going to go and do this test. So I want to give the background to leading up to Nürburgring. And then I got to Nürburgring, went out the first day. First of all, went to see my mechanics on arrival, and I've never seen so much emotion in all my life, because all my mechanics, they just didn't know how to handle it, like, you know. Anyway, went out the first day, reasonably quick, did a few tests, ran all day, and then we put some different dampers on at the end, and the rear damper broke going into the Bosch curve, and I did about 5 360s at about 210 mile an hour, ended up in the gravel, got out of the car, still actually I was a bit emotional, crying, got into the hire car, went back. I had a big long chat with myself that night, up all night, and I had two options, pack my bag, leave, or drive the next day. Next day, got in the car, never thought about it anymore, and from that day onwards, I locked Paul in a little safe in the back of my head. And I never allowed him out until Monday morning. So I got to Nürburgring, I went on pole, Schumacher took pole, I took pole back again, Schumacher went back out, took pole, I had one new set of tyres left, knew that he had already done his lap, so he was doing a fans lap afterwards, trying to be fast, trying to look quick, but it never was. I bolted him a little bit, going out onto the back straight, sort of tried to get out of his way, but didn't really. So coming out of the corner, he cut across my nose and took my left front tyre off the Jaguar. So I was absolutely furious. So I'm now driving this car back on three wheels, trying to get back to the pits. And as I get back to the pits, as I get past the Mercedes garage or Sauber, I'm getting out of the car, and the car's still doing like 50 mile an hour. and I jump on the car, almost fell over. The mechanics are rushing up to stop the car, and one of them trying to hold me. Took my helmet off, threw my helmet in the corner, ran into the Sauber Mercedes garage. I didn't know at that time it was Michael. And Schlesier was taking his helmet off, one of the other drivers for the Sauber Mercedes, was taking his helmet off. So as he's taking his helmet off, I'm winding a right hook to take his head off, and he turns round and he just says, Derek, he said, Schumacher. and with this, Schumacher is running out the corner of the garage. So I take off after him. We go out of the garage. People are pulling on me, and I'm elbowing them and all sorts of things. Go out of the garage, into their transporter, out of the transporter, back out through, into the back of another transporter, and he goes into the front of the transporter where there's a massage table. And then he tries to shut the door on me. So I put my foot in, barge the door open. Now I've got him over the massage table. And again, I'm just about to give him one when I've got Jochen Mass, I think it was, who's another one of their drivers, holding me back. Schlesier out of the corner saying, hit him. And I thought, you know, I mean, now with hindsight, it was a very funny situation. But anyway, we went to the steward's room again, and they never did nothing with me, because I think they understood the emotion I was going through. And they said to Michael that they wouldn't let him race unless he went down and apologized to me. He came down to me on Sunday morning, never looked me in the eyes, and mumbled something like, sorry. Not, look, mate, you know, really, really sorry. Your brother was killed 10 days ago. You know, anything I can do, which is what I think anybody in this room would do.
Yeah.
And I think then you realize that Michael was just a bit different. And in a good way, is not just a bad way. I think Michael was a bit different.
You know what, though, Derek? Right. Maybe had you beaten him up... you know, he
beaten him up. I don't think there would have been any question of him racing if you had.
He might have been a different person later on. Who knows?
I did win the race, by the way.
Yes, quite. And everybody on the planet was delighted that you did. I got to say. Anyway, look, the time is going so fast. I just wanted to take a question from Piers Ruthven, and I think I like this question. He wants your recollections of driving the 1986 Brabham in qualifying trim, because that was about as quick as cars ever got, wasn't it?
I forgot to mention that in my world's worst cars, didn't I? Because that was pretty bad, to be honest. You know, when Bernie rang me and asked me if I would come and drive for him, and the reason Bernie said, one of the main reasons he asked me to drive that car was because when Elio was killed in Rickard in that test, he said within an hour of him having that accident, he had drivers ringing him up to take his drive. And he just said, you know, he said, I understand drivers have to be that sort of person, if you like. He said, but there's a time, you know, there's a time. And I never ever called him. I just thought it was the wrong time. Eventually he called me and called me over, and we did the deal. And I do remember the negotiations, because I sat in the room with Bernie. By the time I got there, I kind of had pumped myself up to thinking, Brabham need me, Bernie Eccleston needs me, BMW need me, the whole team needs me. So by the time I got there, I was worth 50 million quid. You know, I mean, anyway, I got to the negotiations side, and Bernie said, he said, oh, this is the contract. And to be fair to him, it was Elio's contract complete, and less 5/16ths, because obviously 5 races had gone already. And I said, oh, Bernie, I said, you misunderstand. I said, you know, dead man's seat, I've got to pump the team up, I've got to do this, got to do that, and do that. And Bernie said, it was quite easy, he said, you don't understand, Derek. And he slammed the contract down again. This is the contract. So I signed it. So I signed it, and that was it, really. And the car was, because it was a lay-down car, it was a bit like a chewing gum, and it was flexing all over the place, and it was just horrible. The engine was sort of let down. Oh, I mean, it's a beautiful-looking car, but I kind of thought in the back of my head that I thought, well, okay, the car's shite, but I've got Gordon Murray. You know, he has that Midas touch that he would put a set of XYZ springs, a different roll bar, and the next thing you know is I've won the next Grand Prix by five laps. But by that time, he had lost a little bit of focus, shall we say, and enthusiasm, and he was away with the fairies at this stage, and not really a help at all. But so when I got into the car, it was a bit disappointing, but I will still say to this day, the Brabham BMW in qualifying was the most exhilarating car I've ever driven in my life. We had something like 1,350 horsepower. The wastegate was just taken off and a blanking plate put on. And you just had a 7-speed gearbox. We went up 1,500 revs in every single gear for qualifying. This was at Monza, I remember, in particular. And I was on the rev limiter just past the pit exit. So I just could not change gear quick enough. And as you're changing gear, you're smiling because you're thinking, wow, I just couldn't keep up with the car. It was just fantastic. And you talk about, then you had to get it into the corners and you had one lap qualifiers, 1,350 horsepower. It was just fantastic. And I remember, again, that same old corner. I got into the Parabolica on my one qualifying lap, and the thing just went bang. And I remember they couldn't take the gearbox off the engine because the engine was in two halves. And no, it was a fantastic and an amazing, just an experience. It wasn't a good car, but an amazing experience.
Yeah. I mean,
just brute force.
Yeah. None of us can. Well, I can imagine, you know, what it must have felt like. Let's talk a little bit about the BRDC, Derek, if we can. Mr. President, after all. I mean, this is a fantastic thing for you, because I know how much you care about it. And one of our readers here, it's Neil Kirby, actually, says, you know, congratulations. But now you're in this position of power. Can we have the old woodcut back, please?
No, not anymore, no. Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud to be president of the BRDC. It took me a while to accept the role because I felt that stepping in after, first of all, Sir Jackie Stewart, and then Damon, who had done an absolutely marvellous job for the club over the last 4 or 5 years, it was something that was just a little bit past me. I thought that the shoes were just a little bit too big, and it wasn't a role that was really made for Derek Warwick, because two things, really. One is I've lost a bit of confidence in speaking at awards and all that sort of stuff. It's easy when you're a racing driver to speak because you've only got to mention carbon fiber 3 times and you can get through a whole speech, you know. But when you're not a racing driver anymore, you've got to start making sense, you know. And I've never been one for making sense, so, you know, I just thought it was a step too far. And also, I didn't think I had enough credibility. My profile wasn't big enough, you know. I hadn't won world championships in terms of Formula One anyway, and Grand Prix, and I just thought, anyway, the board put massive pressure on me, because I thought I was the right person, and I did have the credibility within our industry, which I think I have. So I eventually took the role, because I'm passionate about the British Racing Drivers Club. I mean, it's a great club. You know, it's a difficult club because you've got 800 members, you're never going to please everybody, bit like you wanting the old Woodcote back. You know, things have moved on. It's a commercial business. It's a very marginal business. You know, the Grand Prix is our only real big profit opportunity, and that's getting less and less with the sanction fees from Bernie. But I think all in all, we delivered the new Pit and Paddock, which is the wing, obviously, a year ahead of its time. We are still developing Silverstone as we speak. We've just got planning permission, which is called the Master Plan, which is giving us an opportunity to talk to third-party investors, which we're doing at the moment. We're in the middle of negotiations for that at the moment. We've got a lot of exciting things that can happen if we can find some outside investors, hotels, museums, Walk of Fame, international kart circuit, debenture grandstands. There's lots of things that we would like and can do, but you know, at the moment we have gone out a little bit on a limb. We have huge borrowings for the first time at the BIDC, but we...
Can you explain that?
We spent something like about 12 million on the circuit. We've obviously put the new wing up. We've used the cash funds that we've already got. So we've had to borrow money in order to complete the project. So it's affordable. We can still run. We're in profit. It's a marginal business. We don't have to sell. We'd like to sell. We'd like to find an investor. We don't have to find an investor. So we're in a very fortunate situation. Having said that, we're also lucky that we've got three great British drivers at the moment, two of which are ex-world champions. And that really puts the cream on the gate. You know, I think without them, you know, we might get 80,000 people. With them, we get 100,000 people. And that's the 20,000 that really gives us the profit. So, you know, we're really always looking for the next Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button. We've got good young driver programs with the rising stars and our superstars. And we work really, really hard, or I work really, really hard, trying to keep all those balls in the air. And to be honest, it's an enormous amount of work. I don't get paid not one penny. I don't even claim expenses, because I feel that this is Derek Warwick paying back motorsport for a wonderful, wonderful career.
Was it a consideration when they were, when you were, as you say, you were sort of trying to make up your mind whether to do it or not? Was that something that concerned you, the sheer amount of time you would have to give it, and whether you had that amount of time available?
I had already committed by that time, because I've been a director now for 5.5 years, and I've been on the club committee for 2 years. So I really know what Silverstone's about. I know what the BIDC is about. I know what our members like and dislike. So I'd already spent all that time, and you know as well as anybody, Nigel, the busier you are, the more you can do. You know, and I have. You know, I've got a garage in Jersey. I've got a race team in Australia. I've got three building companies in the UK. We've just started work on three sites over here, residential. I'm building two big £10 million houses in Jersey. I employ probably 150 people. I get into work at 6:45 every single day of my life, and I'm never home before 6:15. So, you know, I'm still working hard. BIDC is probably between 60 and 75% of that work. Because, I mean, if I open my email now, I've probably got 50 emails to look at. So I haven't got a PA. I do it all myself. I've got a wonderful administration infrastructure within the Honda garage in Jersey, and that I use for the BIDC stuff, and as well as Stuart Pringle, Becky Sims, and the people at the club office. So I'm well organised. You know, I am 21st century. I've got all the mod cons, and life's good.
I tell you what, I think that is exactly why it was such a great appointment. No, I do.
My wife would disagree with that, I'm afraid. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I know she would.
Derek, what do you
but
think
she's
about...
She's not here, though, is she?
What do you think about when you see Bahrain and they were supposed to be... Apparently, 28,000 people watching
claimed,
the Grand Prix claimed 28,000 people. Silverstone last year, I think the official figure for Sunday was 122,000. What do you think about the way that Formula One has gone in terms of these races?
Well, you understand the reasons why they've gone this way, because these guys are paying big, enormous sanction fees. And at the end of the day, Bernie, CVC are there to make money. So you understand that, but they've got to be careful, because the heart of Formula One is the European races. It is Silverstone, it is Monza, it is Monaco, Hockenheim, Nürburgring. We haven't got a French Grand Prix. Ridiculous. Okay, we're talking about it at the moment. Spa, you know, they are the heart. I remember Bernie once saying, manufacturers will come and go, teams will stay. Say he should apply the same philosophy with circuits, because if he keeps
and fans
because if he keeps taking making Formula One too expensive for us, making us spend too much money on the facilities, we will go. You know, there's a lot of circuits out there that are being supported, and I talk about Spa, Monza, Nürburgring, Hockenheim, that have got some kind of government money or local area money. We have not got one penny. So, you know, we do a great job, I think, with Richard Phillips and his team does a great job filling the seats and the grandstands. But you've got countries like Bahrain coming to us, asking us how to fill their grandstands, how to make motor racing attractive to their fans. So we're helping Austin at the moment. We've helped Abu Dhabi. We put a team over there to get them going. Silverstone is used quite a lot by other circuits to sort out their infrastructure.
Are there times when you feel as though the Formula One race is a bit of a sort of ball and chain in terms of, you know, running the circuit and things because of the cost? I mean, heaven forbid we lost the British Grand Prix, but there must be times when you think, God, if we didn't have to spend this much on the F1 race, we'd be in profit by, you know, almost double.
You know, I think it goes back to what I've just said, really. You know, when Bernie cut out Silverstone and was going to Donington, I was just outraged. You know, I was outraged because I knew the sanction fee that Donington had agreed to, and I knew it just couldn't work. It was impossible to work. So it was a pie in the sky. And I don't know whether it's because Bernie's had a little bit of bad blood with BIDC, because I think he did back in the day. But, you know, my advice to... advice is the wrong word. I'd like to say to Bernie... We're now in the 21st century. Move on, man up. You know, we're here to stay. We are 21st century company, i.e. Silverstone BIDC. Forget what happened. You know, what happened with a load of old members, that's water under the bridge. You know, let's move on. And I'd love to sit down with them and have this kind of conversation.
Yeah, wouldn't we all?
And just see whether or not he's still the same person that I signed for in 86. Because let me tell you, in 86, he was, even then, misread. He loves his motor racing. Yeah. This is in 86. He's an absolute racer at heart. Is that gone out of him? I don't think so. I think all the problems that just business, life, media, you guys create for him, us, them, everybody, just takes it away. But yeah, I think our sanction fee is too dear. Our business is too marginal. And if we lost that little cream of 10, 20,000 people, we will struggle. We will really struggle. We'll find other ways of surviving, but it won't be what you're seeing now, let me tell you.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Now, this thing about, you know, don't screw your fans, you know, the bedrock of the sport. And we've reached a point now, we've got races all over the place in places that frankly couldn't care less about Formula One or motor racing at all. And the races have to be run at damn silly times because that's what suits the European audience, you know, which he knows is still the fan base of the sport. He's just not giving them any races actually to go to.
You and I know that Abu Dhabi, Singapore, Bahrain, all those circuits, China, they will not be here in 20 years' time.
No.
Perfectly okay. True.
It would still be the bedrock. If we've still got Formula One cars racing around circuits, the Silverstones, the Nürburgrings, the Spas, the Monza, the Monacos, they will always be here. The same is, that's why Williams and McLaren and Ferrari and those sort of teams will always be here, because they are the bedrock of this wonderful business that we're all involved in. A bit like I just said about manufacturers and what Bernie said about them. You know, I don't hear him saying the same about these circuits, but you and I, and you know, we know that they won't be here for the long haul.
We have run out of time, which is a real shame, because but we do know how important an hour of time is to you now.
But can I charge you then?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, that's nothing, because I don't charge anybody anything, so that's just a nice cup of coffee would be great.
Right, what was I going to say, Derek? Oh, yes, I don't want to close this show without asking you one more question, and that's because so many of our readers are asking it, and I bet you can guess what it is. It's about not being able to drive at Lotus because, effectively, it appeared...
Yes. It's simple, really. I had a contract with Lotus at the end of 85, the shite year at Renault, I think the deal was done, basically. I'd signed my contract, waiting for them to sign theirs. Christmas came. They asked me to come for a meeting. I thought it was just to sign the contract and give me a few bob. And when I got there, I could see that the feeling wasn't right. You know, the mechanics didn't feel right. The personnel didn't feel right. And we sat in this office, and there was a coldness in the office. And it was then announced that I'm really sorry, Derek, but I'm afraid we're going to have to back out of this contract. And I said, well, hang on, we've agreed terms. I've signed my contract. I said, what's the problem here? Well, Ayrton don't want you as a teammate. And I thought, wow, you know, why? I said, I'm an easy guy to get on with. And then it became obvious that Ayrton didn't want me as a teammate because he saw me as a threat, I think in terms as a racing driver, a threat, British, being in a British team, and a threat, the fact that I think he'd already sussed out that the team was on a bit of a decline in terms of money and stuff. So it couldn't give three number one cars. In my contract, it already said that I had equal rights to the spare car. And Ayrton wanted the car for himself, and wanted somebody in there that just bowed down to whatever he wanted. So... I got kicked out of the team. Obviously, Dumfries came into the team, and Ayrton got everything he wanted. He got the two cars. He had full rights on the spare car. When I look back now, you have to admire Ayrton for the single-mindedness because he took a lot of flack. People like Nigel in the British press.
I do remember a conversation with Rhonda on the subject, Derek, have to say, which remains indelibly in my mind.
Yes, I know. You've got to remember that Ayrton had a lot of flack from the British press, but he stood by his guns, and when you look back again with hindsight, he was right.
Yes, he was
right in the fact that what was the best way to further Ayrton Senna's career? And that was not having Derek Warwick in the team.
No, sure, but it might have helped a bit had he spoken to you, bearing in mind that he was the motivation for what they were doing. I mean, I just feel... I can't imagine you doing that, OK? And I can't imagine a lot of other drivers doing that.
But you know
that.
What, Rob? Is that... taking that to one step further, is that why I didn't get myself into a winning situation? Is that why I didn't win a Grand Prix? Is that why I wasn't a world champion? Because maybe... Maybe I wasn't ruthless enough, and I've said that, and actually I was. You know, when I think of the way I used to screw my teammates when I could. Yeah, I think I was pretty ruthless. When I think that I put Eddie Cheever, my teammate in 89, in the wall at Monaco in qualifying because he buggered my quickest lap the lap before. Yeah, I think I can be ruthless, yeah.
Did Ayrton ever talk to you about it?
He sent me a lovely New Year's card wishing me all the best for 86. I don't honestly think he did. I don't honestly think he thought he was doing any harm to me. I think he just thought that I would naturally get another drive somewhere else. You know, but of course everything had gone.
I've enjoyed this one more than any other, I've got to say. The time's just disappeared. Why don't you write a book? I think you should. I think it'd be a big seller.
I think I would love to write a book, but I'd like everything in my life, I would like to do it right. I'd need to put some time to it. I don't want to rattle a book out in 6 months. It would need to take 18 months. It would need to get a few stories from a few people quickly before they all die. But, you know, there's chapters in that book about my family, about my Uncle Stan, about my father, that would just be tremendous. And I could, now that both of them have unfortunately passed away, I could let a few truths out the bag. And I'd love to talk about my brother. I'd like to talk about myself, as you have obviously felt from this hour that's just gone. I'm good at talking. No, but I'd love to put on record for my family, my grandchildren, and so on, put on record the Warwick era, if you like.
I really hope
it's time.
I really hope that you do, and I hope that when you, I don't know how long you'll be president for, but after that, maybe the next big project, you know, will be your book, because it'd be fantastic. And thank you very much for coming in. Before we all go, by the way, if you're ever see Derek Warwick in traffic, I suggest you don't go do anything too silly, or you'll find yourself in the wall. Let me just remind you about our subscription offer, because in all seriousness, it is important to us. You can save over £52 when you subscribe to Motorsport for 2 years. It's a good saving. If you live in the UK, that means you'll pay £36.80 for a year, which is pretty good, and £67.20 for 2 years. And if you look at the cover price, you'll see what a bargain that is. If you really want to do this, then go to our website where there are more details, and that, of course, is motorsportmagazine.com. And don't forget that when you do subscribe, you get the iPad edition absolutely free. And I can assure you that looking at Motorsport magazine on the iPad is a whole new world. Absolutely fantastic. So thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And thanks, Nigel, to Ed, to our editor, Damien, and Derek. Many thanks. Fantastic to see you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye, everybody.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.